The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Carrie Arsenault. Her new book is Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. She joins us on the telephone in Connecticut. Welcome to the program, Carrie.
Hi, Vic. Thanks for having me.
Carrie, I get the feeling that it took you a long time to write this book. When did the idea first come to you? When did it become a book?
Those are two separate questions for me. I started writing about my family back in 2001, and then I started kind of compiling it into stories around 2009, and it probably became a book sometime in 2013, or I thought of it as a book.
Mm.
So it's taken me, almost, 20 years to write it?
Uh-huh.
But really 10 focused years.
Well, it reads like a memoir, but it's much more than that. It's kind of a history of your hometown, your home community. And I have never been to Maine. So reading your book was actually kind of a shock to me because I've always bought into that beautiful Maine vacation land, pristine. And you certainly tell a different story about your town.
Yeah, I'm glad that that happened. I mean, one of the reasons, I think, or one of the whys to write this book was to sort of interrogate that myth about Maine, the blueberry cobblers and the lobsters. And because if we think everything's okay, if people see Maine as just everything's okay and it's this perfect, pristine place, then we ignore those people living in the periphery, like those in my town.
Mm. Tell us about the mill that defines that hometown of yours.
Yeah, so the paper mill is where three generations of my family worked. And I had a happy childhood, I like to say, but I paid a price for that childhood. I think everybody in our town did. Because while the mill provided, economic stability to our town and jobs, it also contributed to the destruction of our health and our environment. It opened in 1901, and from then until now, it's been largely polluting the environment. One of the more nefarious toxics that is created in paper making is dioxin, and that's really the toxic I focus on in this book. There are so many, but this is the one I focus on because it's one of the most dangerous toxics known to humankind. It's created in the bleaching process as a byproduct, and it is just very deeply dangerous to so many aspects of human health, and it's bioaccumulative, and it's a persistent toxic that is really hard to remove from the environment.
You talk to a lot of people. You talk to mm-hmm. people who worked there, people who were married to people who worked there. But the real root of this actually came from a physician. Am I right?
I actually think no.
No?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, really the story started, like I said, it started in 2001 or really 2009 where I started researching my family tree, right?
Uh-huh.
So the first thing was my grandfather's obituary. I found this little scrap of paper when I was doing this research, and I realized it contained information about him I hadn't known, like where he was born and how he died and all that kind of stuff. And so I sought to confirm those details. Well, come to find out, most of it was wrong. All of it was wrong, actually, or somehow incomplete. And so that obituary showed me that the archives of history can be really inaccurate. And so I wondered what else could be wrong, right?
Mm.
So, and I found out as I kept following this path that much was wrong. And what I did, instead of following information that was known, I followed this absent information or ambiguous information, and it laid the groundwork for the story and the structure of the book, which is to say there's like many, many tributaries of inquiry that follow a lot of unexpected paths. And that's the more interesting story anyway, to try and find things that are missing or don't want to be found or can't be found. And Doc Martin was one of those tributaries, I would say. As I followed my family tree, I contacted his wife, his widow, who was also a nurse in town. And I contacted her about family information, and she started telling me all about this environmental issue that I really hadn't known about, and that's where Doc Martin enters. So I really think that the story is more aligned with a search for identity, home, and an interrogation of Maine and myth, and Doc Martin is just part of that. I think he also is kind of a symbol of the mill itself, because this mill, even though it dumped loads and millions and millions of pounds of toxics into our environment, it also gave our town life. And Doc Martin was like that too. He was a really good doctor, and he tried fighting this environmental mess. But he was also an abuser. He emotionally abused his wife. So it's a conundrum, both he and the mill.
It's really a story of suppression of information. Anytime someone at the mill complained about some sort of ailment, they would always whitewash it.
Yeah.
And Doc Martin, he really paid a price for his curiosity, didn't he?
He did. I mean, he lost friends, jobs. He got sued for it. He became sort of a lightning rod for a lot of things. And then he ended up dying of cancer as well, the same kind of cancer he was investigating. They hid things from him. I felt like things were hidden from me, or things I couldn't find for whatever reason. It continues.
I also kept feeling the image of this river coursing through your town, which is the reason why the mill was built there in the first place, and how we treat rivers. How we throw stuff in the river. Let's throw my problem in the river and let someone else deal with it downstream. And this is what we do as a culture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the river is, I mean, maybe it's the oldest metaphor in the book, but it literally is it gave our town life and it gave our town death. And it's true. We think, if we clean up our problem, even if we cleaned up our problems, like everybody says, oh, it's still less polluted here. But yeah, things are going downstream. They're going down into the Atlantic Ocean. They're going down into lobsters. They're going up into the air. And like I say in the book, pollution is not provincial either. We don't stay where it doesn't stay where we put it, even if we try to put it away. Mm. And usually that pollution affects people and metaphorically downstream, who are more disenfranchised than most people who are living on the fence line communities or on sacrifice zones, as they call it, too.
You describe something that they have a two-word name for, but I'm just going to call them cakes that float in the river.
Oh, yeah.
What is a cake?
I talked to a gentleman that had studied the Androscoggin River, which is the name of the river. He studied in, I think it was like the 50s or something, at Bates College. He studied under Lawrence, who was the river master. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him later in his life. I think he's passed away since. But he said the sulfite liquor that was dumped into the river, combined with these cellulosic fines, he called them, F-I-N-E-S, the river already contained them. And so that sulfite liquor combined with those cellulosic fines created these gray, foul materials called these something cakes.
Uh-huh.
And there were probably like 100 acres of it floating in the river. Ugh. Now, that's something I don't recall seeing as a kid, but what I do recall seeing is, you know, pretty disgusting rainbow-colored water and yellowed foam, a really rotten egg smell upon the river. I mean, we used to play games like, what color do you think the river is today? I mean, in 1970, when I was three, it was one of the most polluted rivers in the United States, on the top 10, named by Newsweek. So it got pretty bad in the 70s, right before the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act.
And in the 1970s, the early 1970s, 50 years ago, President Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. So we don't have to worry about these dioxins, do we?
We do have to worry about them.
I'm being facetious.
I know. It's interesting because the dioxin debate, I should say, to people who aren't familiar with it, which seem to be a lot of people, it happened in the 80s and the 90s when the EPA was doing an assessment of dioxin, because what they found in the early 80s was loads of dioxin in fish downstream from paper mills. Our mill, our river and our mill being one of the highest, you know, amounts of dioxin found in these fish. And then so subsequently, and to make a long story short, they required the paper industry to start bleaching paper in a different way. Instead of using elemental chlorine, they used chlorine dioxide, which drastically reduced the amount of dioxin that was released into the environment, but it didn't eliminate it completely. So both in this drastic reduction of dioxin and in some reports that the EPA has not released in final form, there's still a very clear and present danger of dioxin, even in the smallest amounts. So it's still being produced, it's still being released into the environment in various ways, not just by paper mills. Even wildfires create dioxin, in fact. But it's also in the environment, and like I said, it stays in the environment. And worse, it stays in our bodies because it's bioaccumulative. The further up the food chain it goes, the more toxic it becomes. And like right at the top of the food chain are babies, you know, who are breastfeeding from their mothers. So if a mother eats a hamburger and then the mother breastfeeds the baby gets that dioxin. I think the EPA said something like 77 times the amount they suggest a baby should get. But they even suggest any baby should get any dioxin is kind of crazy to me, but there we are.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. My guest in the book nook, Carrie Arsenault, her book Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. And we are recording this on Tuesday, November 3rd, Election Day. And I thought of you when I listened to that last presidential debate. It really struck me, the parallels between what you're talking about in Milltown and when they got on the topic of these communities that are terribly polluted with chemicals and the destruction that's causing to people, and the reply of our sitting president who said, these people are making really good incomes. And that's really what Milltown's all about, isn't it?
Yeah. I couldn't believe he said that. I mean, that's exactly what the book is about. I mean, you know, people like to think it's a choice that some people make to, you know, work in this mill. And yes, there are choices that people make, but towns like this, you know, there are pressures that they've been facing, not just environmentally, but, you know, for the last 50 years, labor strikes, you know, deindustrialization of America, the dehiscence of rural America, you know, everybody leaving, going to urban places, recessions, Reagan's trickle-down effect that had no effect, really, except to let us know we were on our own. Mm-hmm. You know, the working class was sent into an economic and identity tailspin, and they were largely ignored by the nation state and the global concerns, I think. And Trump, it was interesting because my hometown, too, I don't know if you know this or remember reading this, but during the 2000 election, they went from the biggest Obama supporters to the biggest Trump supporters in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And without really going and asking people why, I tried to figure out why that could happen in such a blue collar town, you know, whereas usually we had voted Democrat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Trump did a few things. He tapped into decades of broken promises and broken policies, mistrust of our government, especially when it came to environmental issues. I mean, they abandoned us, you know, and he kind of tried to empathize with the sort of no life that we lived. But in Clinton, she had already accepted the deconstruction of the working class. While the working class were still struggling to keep their jobs. So they were hungering for change, any change, I think, even if it required making a Faustian bargain of sorts. Mm. And I actually believed, too, in their idea for a moment.
Yeah. We haven't actually named the towns. You grew up in Mexico, Maine, which is right next to Rumford, Maine, which is where the mill is located. And I would say about half of this book is reminiscence, your memories of childhood or your experiences traveling around the world with your husband. And it's really a love letter in a way to your parents. They sound like they were just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a love letter to my whole hometown, really, in an interesting way, is that it was like being in a really complicated relationship with the town, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, the plot of my book, like you said, is me going home and leaving and going home and leaving and just kind of seeing my town in so many different ways. It was interesting because I would go back and I would see how it was, and then I would see how it is, and then I would think, okay, wait, maybe was that how I thought it was? You know, it was really complicated sort of having that dialogue with my town and thinking about the past and thinking about the present. In fact, even the book even talks to each other. The end of the book talks to the beginning of the book back and forth. So that's a conversation too. Like chapter 16 talks to chapter 1. You know, it emphasizes that connection with the past and the present that I'm constantly, I think, interrogating, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It was, but yeah, my parents were pretty great. I mean, my father worked in that paper mill for 45 years, as did his father. And he basically sacrificed his life, I would say. He got asbestosis from the paper mill. He also had heart disease, which has been connected to environmental pollution, such as our mill produces. And he died. And he gave me the opportunity to be able to tell this story.
I think my favorite anecdote is when you're talking about skiing and what a great skier he was, and when you were just a little tiny girl and he was skiing down the hill with you, that is so cool.
That's how he taught us all to ski. He would put us in between his legs and face us forward and hunch over, the poor guy. And that's what was so lovely about it. And that probably is like a symbol of how my parents were too. You know, they just really, it took care of us, making sure we wouldn't fall, you know, just providing just enough stability so we didn't fall. But at the same time, they let us think we were doing it on our own. When I was a little kid, I thought I was skiing all by myself, but really he was there to hold me up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how my parents really were and are. My mother's still alive, I should say.
Yeah. There's a point in the book where you decide to become an activist in your town over a situation where a powerful conglomerate was coming in and they wanted something from your town and you tried to get involved and this didn't turn out the way you expected, did it?
No. So that was Nestle Waters. Yeah, I would say I was an accidental activist. I went to town to help to do a sort of educational or informational program about Nestle, who had sort of marched into town and was interested in buying water rights. And in the middle of writing this book, and I thought, oh God, this is just like The Mill, except maybe perhaps worse in some ways, because, you know, The Mill at least started with a benevolent sort of man who had the best interests of the town in his mind, whereas Nestle really just generally doesn't, and that's been proven over and over. So I had this informational meeting with Rebecca Martin, who was actually Doc Martin's daughter. And after the meeting, people asked me if I would sort of lead this group, keep talking about this issue, and to see what they could do to maybe keep Nestle out of town. And for a while, I was very involved, and then sort of things started to get a little funky, and some people in the group thought I really didn't belong in the group because I didn't live there anymore, and thought maybe that it was best that I sort of delinked from their group. And of course, at first I was mad, and then I was hurt, and then I was, I don't know. Then I thought, you know what? We both had different ways of coming at an issue. And I thought, they're probably right. They're the ones that are on the ground. They're the ones feeling this acutely. You know, why should I be the one to sort of guide what's going to happen in that town? They're the ones that need to deal with it. But so they continued to do their work, and I continued to write this book, which I felt like, I mean, there's a pretty long chapter in here about Nestle, so I figured that's my contribution to this sort of fate that was going to befall Rumford in Mexico.
And apparently Nestle has all these brands of bottled water, and there's one called Poland Spring that's very popular. And supposedly all the water comes from Maine, and so that's why they wanted to go to Rumford and get this arrangement where they would pump all this water out of your aquifer. And the whole thing just sounds insane. Water is so precious, and they just wanted, they were just going to give it all away, and they did, right? Aren't they pumping the water out as we speak?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're paying the water district money. That doesn't really go to the town. The water district is a semi-municipal organization, and then so the money goes to the water district, basically. And yeah, they're pumping out, God, I can't remember the amount, but a lot, millions, more than is reasonable. And, you know, then selling it back to people at, you know, some 600 times the price. I don't know. I'm probably exaggerating these numbers, but they're in my book. 245 gallons a minute or something like that. Yeah, it's a lot. It's not what, you know, when Poland Spring, it is from Maine, and when Poland Spring first started, it was a guy and a horse, you know, taking clean water around to people. So because back then there was no FDA or anything, and nobody regulating the cleanliness of water. So this guy tapped into Poland Spring, and he found suddenly his family, they all started feeling better. Well, of course they did, because the water was clean instead of dirty. So, you know, it was reasonable to carry it around in a horse cart. But, you know, at this kind of level that Nestle is drilling for water and selling water, especially in a town that, you know, it's one of the most valuable resources they have, ironically, even though they have polluted the water, too. I mean, it's very complicated. Not this water, necessarily. I mean, I have no idea, but it's a complicated thing. And Nestle swoops into these disenfranchised communities and promises them the moon and gives them, I don't know, gives them a pencil. I can't think of anything smaller. I don't know.
Well, after reading your account of that landfill that they have there in Rumford and this poor guy that wanted to drill a well next to his motor lodge, I can't imagine anyone would want to be selling bottled water from that area. That's just crazy. I grew up in Des Moines, and I've always been someone who read the obituaries. And even as a kid, I would read the obituaries, and total strangers, I wanted to know. Back in Des Moines, they would publish the cause of death in 90% of the obituaries. And I noticed a lot of these guys that worked at this tire manufacturing plant, they would retire after 30 years of service, and within 2 years, all of them were dying of cancer. I moved to Ohio, and they don't really give the cause of death very often in obituaries. I know Ohio's got some pollution issues, and I was wondering, In Maine, in Rumford, when they publish the obituaries, do they say the cause of death? Because you would think that that would be a red flag. All these people are dying of all these related cancers, and some of them are pretty rare.
Some of them are really rare. They do publish it sometimes. I think it's really now it's up to the family. You know, it's not as everybody writes their own obituaries nowadays. But what I in order to capture some of that data, I started this project on my website through this grant I had won, and it's called the Cancer Yearbook. And what I've been trying to do, and I haven't really put my full force of it behind it yet, but I will in the new year, is to I've asked people who live there or who have lived there if they would share the diagnosis of their cancer and information about it and their name and give me a headshot. And I've put that up on my website and called it Cancer Yearbook because I figure if I can get a critical mass up there, like you say, it's got to say something, right? You know, for like what kind of cancers these people are having, the age they're having, so many young people. So I'm trying to capture some of that information. It's not a really scientific way, but it's a, and neither is this book in some ways. I mean, there's a lot of research that went into it, but I think there's a lot of evidence that sort of doesn't necessarily get looked at. And like you said, I think looking at the way people die is really telling. And that's something else I learned while I was looking at these obituaries of my family and other people is that, you know, even my father's, there's a whole chapter about his obituary and it doesn't really say, you know, all the problems that went into his death. You know, it's not really a true picture of how a person dies. You know, that final line, cause of death, well, it's usually something like, you know, pneumonia, you know, but with underlying causes. So yeah, that is something, I agree, it's something that is really telling.
Well, it struck me as incredibly cynical when you note that you had this bleaching area in the plant and in the paper mill, and they would they would put the older fellows in there. They wouldn't put the younger ones in there because they knew if they did that they would start getting sick, and they still have a lot of time left to work the plant. So they'd put the older guys in there and then put them work for a few years, and then they retire, and then they die.
That sounds just like what you found, right? So well, maybe it's a nationwide practice.
I don't know. That was just my sense. I know nothing about that plant. I'm just saying I noticed that.
Yeah.
It was a tire
plant.
That
was one thing in my grandfather's obituary that I didn't know. You know, it said he had worked in the bleach room and that he died of stomach cancer. And so those two things were like, oh, that's interesting. You know, little did I know that those things are connected or, you know, anyway.
The book is Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. Carrie Arsenal has been my guest, and she wrote it. And it's beautifully written. I commend you. It's just a wonderful book to read. You're really a great writer.
Thank you, Vic. Very kind.
Yeah, just really, really well done. One of my favorites of the year so far.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you for reading it.
You bet. Thank you so much for your time and for being on the program, Carrie.
Okay. Bye.
Don't say goodbye. I got to sign off.
Oh.
Okay. We're not done. Okay. My guest has been Carrie Arsenault, the book Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Vic.